All right, we are back here on the Logic Consortium, and we have another renowned guest. Jake, do you want to do the lead-in here?
Professor Epstein?
Yeah, I'm here.
How are ya?
I'm fine.
We got
you.
Professor Epstein, the James Parker Hall legal scholar at the University of Chicago School of Law.
Yeah, and I also have a Hoover Institution appointment, which people are supposed to remember.
At Stanford, very nice. At senior fellow at the Stanford Hoover Institution. I do remember hearing about that on Russ Roberts' show, the Econ Talk.
Yes, that's right. Russ is somebody who seems to let me run on almost indefinitely, but I don't think you'll do that.
So, Professor Epstein, we're here to talk about one of your recent books. I believe it's about a year and a half old, how the progressives rewrote the Constitution.
Yeah, it's 2 years old, but still fresh, I like this.
And so basically, I want to start off, who are the progressives and how have they rewritten the Constitution?
Well, you know, that's the right questions to ask. American politics in the period between 1900 and 1930 had what you might call the sort of people who were quite content or relatively content with the major changes in consequence of the industrialization that took place in the post-Civil War period. And they thought, for the most part, that traditional legal structures would work fairly well with respect to the new technologies and were not sort of consciously trying to sort of innovate new forms of government programs. The progressives believe that industrialization transformed the relationship between the individual and the firm and therefore required some intervention by the state in order to rectify a balance that they saw going rapidly out of kilter. And this expressed itself in many, many different ways. One way it expressed itself was with respect to how you respond to the problem of industrial accidents, people who get injured on the job. And the traditionalists were willing to live with a world of assumption of risk. If you wanted to take your chances, you did so. If not, then you bargained for something else. The progressives said, no, 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 there's too much imbalance of bargaining power. We have to either boost up the common law action so that people have a greater chance of success, or better, we should displace it with a mandatory workman's compensation system, which in fact was introduced in fairly large numbers in the United States in the decade between 1910 and 1920. If you then look at the consumer side, the dominant sort of collective enterprise of the period was first the railroads and then the trusts. And with respect to the railroads, the progressives were somebody who said you must regulate the rates on these things and then proceeded to try to figure out how, because they certainly charged a lot of money in many cases and there were lots of anomalies. And the progressive position was that you should regulate them very aggressively and you didn't have to worry about the confiscation that might take of the capital invested in the line. And the conservatives actually conceded the point on regulation that it was necessary, but wanted it to be subject to a reasonable rate of return for a competitive industry standard so that the confiscation risk could be obviated.
So this is with natural monopolies. They agreed.
You have natural monopolies, network industries. Essentially, you never had this problem before 1850 because you couldn't put together a system which would deliver natural gas or electricity or telephones or, in fact, railroads. And what the modern insight, in a sentence, is that whenever you have these networks that everybody must join in order for anybody to be fully effective, you can't have competitive solutions, which means that some form of regulation is conceded. And the progressives were in favor of very broad levels of discretion, and the more classically liberal-oriented people thought that the regulation of natural monopolies had to be subject to some restraints on what governments did. So there was that big gap between them over the nature and the type of regulation. In other kinds of industries, like, for example, in sugar with E.C. Knight, which was the great case from 1895, and cases involving concrete pipes and so forth, you did not have networks. You just had goods that were mass-produced. And the progressives were, for the most part, fairly insistent on an aggressive antitrust law to break up the combinations and restraint of trade. And at the same time, they were equally insistent that the antitrust laws never, ever applied to labor unions, notwithstanding the power that they may have over the labor market. And so in 1914, in the Clayton Act, they essentially joined forces with the agricultural industries and said that agricultural cartels and labor cartels are, by and large, outside the scope of the antitrust law. So you have all of the movements moving on in those areas. That's the two things. On sort of jurisdictional grounds, the traditional constitution tended to afford a lot of power to the states, and also, therefore, to encourage, almost by necessity, some competition between the states with respect to tax levels and regulations, so that if state A wants to have a child labor law of 16 years of age, the firms might move to state B, where the law would be 14 to 12 years old for the minimum age that you could hire somebody at, and businesses would start to move. The progressives, therefore, were very much systematically in favor of national regulations for what they perceived to be national markets, not only with respect to the railroad lines, which were in fact subject, for the most part, not completely, to national regulations under the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, but for any industry that could walk, talk, or squawk. They wanted to make sure that you could always have national regulation, and then, of course, unless the federal government precluded it, they were also equally in favor of having state regulations on the same kinds of business. So when you start looking at what's going on here, the question is, you have this very large extent of regulation on businesses. And in addition, another component which was important in the period was that the progressives basically thought that inequalities of wealth generated certain major social dislocations, and so they would fight in favor of things such as progressive taxes, whereas the conservatives on the court were probably much more comfortable with flat taxes, which had less of an overt redistribution quality. Put it all together, and you add it up, it without question, the progressives were the fans of big government and national government. And how do you reconcile progressivism with a constitution that seemed to have the opposite premises? The first of these premises was that huge amounts of sovereignty were resided exclusively within the states, and that the powers of the national government were few and enumerated, to use the phrase of Madison, and that, in effect, on the substantive side, that voluntary contracts and strong property rights were essential features of a strong constitutional order. So you've got to figure out, if you're a progressives, how you take a constitution that's written by the likes of Adam Smith and John Locke and turn it into a document which is comfortable with Woodrow Wilson's view of comprehensive government, which in effect acts on the strength of administrative expertise in order to implement these grand programs on a national level.
And it seemed like the court was, in terms of these national level regulations, it seems like the court, even in the old court, was pretty responsive to allowing...
They were not. In the book, I make it very clear, these guys were not anarchists. They weren't even pure libertarians. But they were certainly not progressives. And you ask the question of what it means for the progressives. I've told you who they are. How did you rewrite the Constitution? They turned it from a constitution that was comfortable to limited government libertarians, not anarchists, classical liberals, if you will, into a document which is perfectly congenial with essentially modern social democratic theory. And this is a very big transformation. And I am sort of the Grinch who stole Christmas, and I believe that they made a mistake, not only in terms of the way in which they did things doctrinally, but even after you take into account all the changes in the social order and so forth, that the classical liberal conception was in fact sufficiently flexible that it would provide a better template for which we could organize the economic and social life of a nation. So essentially I'm arguing on two sides. I'm arguing that there was this transformation that took place that was not defensible in terms of the traditional tools of constitutional interpretation. And in addition to that, I'm saying this was the use of the wrong kind of constitutional ingenuity in order to achieve a result which was worse than the one that we had. And a lot of this, of course, depended upon your response to the industrialization. And the progressives didn't quite carry the day with industrialization. They won major victories, certainly through legislation, and the government was a much bigger place in 1930 than it was in 1900. But what really sent them over the top was the view that the traditional legal order could not respond to the absolute massive dislocations associated with the Depression. And they said, only we can get you out of the dig hole, which by implication they thought classical liberal theories had gotten into. So there's this whole question of how do you explain the Depression becomes extremely important. And one of the things that I try to explain in the book is that the progressives just don't understand what is the source of a Depression. And they attacked institutions that essentially had nothing to do with its creation and whose alteration only made the problem marginally more difficult, perhaps even substantially more difficult than it was without it.
And so we're talking about national regulation such as, you know, the Wickard v. Filburn case.
Well, Wickard and Filburn is a case. It's not a regulation, but this is a very nice example for you, for your audience. Let me just say what was going on here. One of the things that the progressives did is when they looked at any industry, they always thought that things that did benefits to the industry did not necessarily do harm to anybody else. And there's no question that there was a glut of agricultural produce in certain places in certain times in the 1930s, which drove prices down very, very low. The classical liberal response is if you have over concentration inside a industry, which reduces price to the point where it cannot cover cost, you have people go bankrupt and try something else. And if you allow this to happen continuously, you'll get an orderly liquidation, slow shrinkage in a fair of business, instead of an absolute calamitous drop. So the progressives, in effect, would have to say, well, we really don't want to keep guys who make horseshoes in place when it turns out that the automobile has killed the demand and you can't kind of keep it to the market. The early New Deal in particular was very much sort of corporatist in the sense that their response to ruinously low prices was all sorts of efforts to prop up these markets. And in agriculture, what they did is they wanted to get a system where they ran a nationwide cartel, that is a system of allocation, which would tell each farmer how much acreage they could put into use and how much of a crop, therefore, that they could start to harvest. And the way in which they ran this through the Agricultural Adjustment Acts was to have a kind of a nationwide plebiscite in which you started to assign acreage growth for everybody. Now the question is, how do you do this under the federal power when the Commerce Clause to the United States says Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations amongst the several states and with the Indian tribes? And in Gibbons and Ogden, which was a famous decision, which I talk about in the book, by Chief Justice Marshall, he came to the conclusion that we have to give a very broad reading to commerce, by which he meant it covers navigation and intercourse, that is, trade between citizens in one state and citizens in another. So he did not think that if you were running a local bus line, even though you were engaged in trade or navigation, that it would be a form of interstate commerce. And he explicitly excluded from the power of the federal government to regulate agriculture and manufacture. Well, if you then look at this, what would be the power that the federal government could have at most with respect to the way in which it organizes an agricultural cartel? And the answer is it could stop people from shipping goods or restrict the amount of goods that they could ship either into foreign nations or across state lines. People who are faced with cartels know that the prices are very high, and therefore, if they could find a way to expand the supply a little bit, they could make a fortune. And so what folks did is that they couldn't send the grain cheaply from Kansas to Missouri because it was an interstate transaction. They would resell it in the state of Kansas somewhere else out on the west. And therefore, what happens is the intrastate sales of wheat, for example, would in effect increase the supply so that your ability to regulate the interstate markets would not do the kinds of price supports that you need. So sure enough, before Wickard and Filburn, in a case involving dairies, was basically the same issue, the Wrightwood Dairy case, the Supreme Court says, given the fact that the sales in the intrastate market influence those in the interstate market, commerce amongst the several states means commerce in one state, which influences what takes place in any other state.
And looking at the current court right now, they continue to have a pretty very expansive view of the Commerce Clause in light of their, you know, the Gonzales v. Raich decision and Scalia's concurrence in Necessary and Proper, which even seems broader than the Wicker.
Well, they certainly, nobody in this court has the willingness to undo Wickard and Filburn, to put it mildly. But that doesn't make it correct. I mean, what it shows, in effect, is that there is the real problem of accreted wisdom so that you have something in place for 70 years, which is what's the true with Wicked and Filbert, 66 to be precise. And somebody's going to say it's real hard to reverse that. And Scalia himself never knows whether he's doing this as a matter of original construction, where he knows it's absurd. I mean, they all know it's absurd. Or in effect of saying, look, you know, entire institutions have grown up around this, and we just don't think we could reverse it. But anyhow, to go back to the historical story for just a second. The second half of it is, well, if you can't sell the stuff to somebody else inside the same state, does that mean you're going to stop producing it? And the answer is no. You'll vertically integrate. So it used to be you owned a farm that made wheat, and you sold the wheat to the guy who owned the cows on the ranch next door, right? What happens is one of the two institutions buys the other, and then, in effect, you're feeding your own wheat to your own cows. And if you go back and you read the briefs in this case, a very large percentage of wheat construction or consumption was, in fact, organized along that ground because people changed their mode of institutional arrangements inefficiently in order to defeat the cartel. So if you want to put the cartel in place, you have to now say that if you feed your own grain to your own cows, you're engaged in interstate commerce. Ho, ho, ho. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court did, because they believed in cartels. Now, somebody like myself, who believes in competitive markets in grains where they're easily done, say, this is just crazy. I mean, what you're doing is you're creating massive dislocations in the Constitution in order to create massive dislocation in agricultural markets. And the utter curse of decisions like Wicked and Filbert on modern production, in effect, creates this exactly same system of allotments and allocations so that agricultural policy in the United States is as grotesque now as it was in 1940, even though there's slightly different cast of characters who are winning. And it involves not only the allocation domestically, but all the huge tariffs and burdens and restrictions by way of quota that are done on foreign trade with respect to this stuff. So, I mean, I don't feel apologetic in saying that if you blew up Wicked and Filbert with respect to agricultural cartels, that the world would come to an end. In fact, it would not. Once you tell farmers, you guys are in a competitive market and there's no one that's going to bail you out, you know what happens? Instead of fighting for legislation, they try to modernize their plants more than they would otherwise do. When they removed the agricultural subsidies in New Zealand about 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was a beginning fear that the whole industry would collapse. But these guys became so ingenious that working in the export market, they sell much more now than they ever sold before because they're so much better at what they do. So I don't fear transitions. What I fear is the willingness to make them gradual, because if you say, well, we'll do this over 10 years, 2 years later you get a different Congress and the whole program goes to hell. And if you could open the thing wide, it's very difficult to close it up again. But that's a classic illustration on the Commerce Clause side of how it is that you start with a doctrine on interstate commerce, which allows you to regulate shipments across state borders, and expand it so that it covers everything under the sun. And the current Supreme Court is conservative in the sense that they don't want to undo established doctrine. I don't think if you took the five and the government tried to come forward with this program today, and Wicked and Filbert was not a precedent, that they would bite. I think they would probably resist it, saying that's not the way the world had worked. But these guys actually thought that this would help stop the deflation and the dislocations of the Depression, and they were just whistling Dixie. There's nothing you could do by making the micro markets more inefficient to improve the efficiency of the global markets. There's only two things you can do to help that. One is to repeal the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which everybody concedes to be within the jurisdiction of the federal government as a regulation of foreign commerce. And the second thing is you could make sure that all the currency irregularities that were brought into the system with the massive deflation in the 1930s were stabilized, preferably by reinflating at some very considerable cost the currency so as to avoid all of the huge bankruptcies that took place when debts became essentially much, much harder to pay off because the dollars were worth so much more they were than they were at the time that the contracts were made. But this is a constant mistake that I point out in the book, which is the typical progressive mind doesn't understand that there's no such thing as a macroeconomic fix for a microeconomic fix, that is fixing particular contracts that's going to solve a macroeconomic problem having to do with tariffs on the one hand or with money supply on the other.
Professor Epstein, yeah. So Commerce Clause aside, it seems like you're saying also is an economic matter that these government regulations often bring greater losses than they actually provide in gains.
Yeah, well, that's the definition of a cartel, is that essentially the gains to the members tends to be always greater, always smaller, rather than the losses to the customers. That's the whole point of an antitrust law. And in fact, by the end of the New Deal period, after 1938, a man named Thurmond Arnold gets appointed as the Assistant Secretary for Antitrust, and he now becomes the great trust buster. So you have this odd situation that on the one hand, the government is furiously defending agricultural cartels, and on the other hand, they're suing, for example, Alcoa on the grounds that they engaged in market domination, which is a violation of the Sherman Act.
So you think...
Same time.
Are you saying that typically these government regulations are benefiting those with political leverage at the expense of...
the general public.
And would you say also of the poor?
Oh, yeah. On the agricultural stuff, it's pretty clear. I actually managed to find a bunch of surveys which said, in effect, you know, every 2% increase in price will yield a such and such a decrease in the number of calories that are gotten by the bottom portion of the population. So that if you're thinking about
broken
it,
down to calories consumed. That's
yeah, I mean, literally, that, you know, that you made people who needed 2,400 calories a day end up with 2,200 calories a day. I mean, there are relationships like that which agricultural economists have found. I don't claim to have done the empirical work, and I haven't checked the math and so forth, but I can certainly tell you, if you believe as I do, that every time you change prices, you change the quantities that are sold, as well as the price at which they're sold, then you can't assume that the regulation has gain for the intended parties and no cost on anybody else. And that, of course, was another progressive mindset. That somehow or other, the only people who should be involved or interested in agricultural cartels are, of course, farmers.
Well, it seems
to
a little.
Farmers, consumers.
Then it would seem a little ironic because a lot of times. I think we tend to associate these progressives with people that want to increase the overall welfare of society, in particular the lower class. And would you suggest then that the best tack for them to take would be more of a government hands-off if they really want to increase?
Well, there are two programs. The progressives did believe in redistribution, and they were therefore in favor of progressive taxes. And certainly... even in the classical period, before 1937, there was no resistance to progressive income taxes that was raised by anybody in the Supreme Court, or in fact, even taxes that were targeted against the corporations. By 1920, it was pretty clear that with very few minor exceptions, the federal government had virtually plenary power on how it would structure taxes on the one hand, how it would exempt certain transactions from taxes, and the rates it would choose for the taxes that remained on property or earnings that remained inside the rate base. I mean, so the classical liberal conservative judges gave up on that. I do not. My view about it is a classical liberal government is, in effect, a very strong flat tax guy, probably on consumption, probably not on capital gains. But that's a position which nobody has been prepared to defend in the cases, although we do believe in classical liberal positions with respect to freedom of speech, much more than we do with respect to property rights. And when 25 years ago, the state of Minnesota decided it was going to put in a progressive tax on the income from newspapers, it was struck down as unconstitutional in violation of the First Amendment. So, I mean, it's not as though the argument I'm making has no analogs. In fact, the basic principle is if you care enough about property rights like you care about many speech rights, particularly political speech, you'll come up in exactly the same place. You'll have a very broad definition of what counts as speech, just as you have one of property and so forth, and you'll have relatively narrow justifications for limiting what an owner of property or the owner of a newspaper can do, and you will tend to favor general flat tax type arrangements with respect to all of them. That was certainly the Lockean position. It was Smith's position. They were all flat tax guys. They didn't spend an enormous amount of time developing it, but it's pretty much unmistakable from reading it. And well, the progressives could have been okay on redistribution. I mean, you could survive that, as we've survived it since then. But what you cannot do is assume that the cartelization is going to have benevolent effects. If you want to have redistribution, the best thing to do is to run it exclusively through a tax system.
So you're not arguing against the ideals of the progressives. You're saying that some of their policy measures have suffered from the law of unanticipated consequences.
Well, not some. I think virtually all. It's difficult to say this because one of the things that's striking about everything the progressives did, okay, is they always gave the rhetoric of inclusion. They wanted to get people back into the system. But in virtually each and every case, the device that they came up with was a cartel or a restriction on entry by rivals or both. So that you can't just be accidentally always coming up with the wrong conclusions. You really have to have a very odd mindset. And I don't think it's because when they decided to help farmers, they meant to help hurt consumers in poor places. I think what they really did not have was a complete and accurate substantive grasp of the way in which these various proposals would operate. I mean, I'm always struck when I read progressive stuff, even today, and that, you know, it's like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, so each of them chomping at the bit about how wonderful it is to raise the minimum wage to help the poor. And, you know, they'll say, well, it's a $10 minimum wage in a city like San Francisco, and that doesn't hurt the poor. And you know what the answer is? It turns out the market wage in San Francisco is over $10, so it doesn't have much effect at all. But when you do it nationally at 10 bucks and you're trying to impose the same tax in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that you do in San Francisco when the labor costs are three times as much, you're just basically going to make everybody in San Francisco richer because they've already adopted to this economy, and you're going to wipe out the folks in the small towns where the cost of living are lower and the wage structure follows accordingly. But you can't get that across to them. I mean, it's not as... I mean, if you look at the current modern American political position, at least on the Democratic side, the Republicans are silent at this moment. They're all progressives. And what they've done is they've added a couple of things onto it. The progressives never spoke about sort of a right to health care. For them, it was enough to have a right to food and a right to housing and a right to farm and so forth. It took basically another 10 years before the health care stuff became part of a regimen of positive rights. Truman was the first president who actually tried to get that through, but the opposition was too strong. The doctors were against the nationalization of the health care system. But progressivism is alive and well in the United States today, as is protectionism, another thing that the progressives of the earlier eras did. If you want to keep cartels at home, you want tariff barriers against products coming in from overseas.
Professor Epstein, where would you attribute the source of positive rights, claims to positive rights in the United States?
Wait, I mean the intellectual source or the political source?
Both.
Well, the political source is that the people who are pushing for these things tend to be concentrated. They can do their sums. They realize that their members get all of the gains from it, and they suffer only a relatively small fraction of the loss. And so what I always like to say is the winners from legislation get a larger share of a smaller pie, and when you multiply the two numbers together, they're better off. So they'll fight for it, and they can organize for this. Whereas, on the other hand, the losers get a smaller share of a smaller pie, so they're doubly cursed. There's no way if you shrink the pie you can make everybody happy, right? I mean, it's just a sheer mathematical impossibility. But the interest groups understand that, and it's not just left-wing interest groups that understand that. On a whole variety of trade issues, you get large unions joining up with large factories in order to prevent the importation, for example, of foreign steel. So this is a game that everybody can play. It's not a game that only labor unions or farmers can play. You can play it so long as you have an economic stake and are willing to engage in organization on the one hand or, in fact, exclusion on the other. But the Republicans, on average, historically, were a little bit less willing to play the game than the Democrats.
We had,
they were certainly not immune from it, because remember, all the farm stuff is heavily driven by Republicans.
We had the chairman of the Department of Economics, Don Boudreau, show a couple weeks ago, and we proposed that, you know, maybe if there was, people weren't worried about if they lost their job, you know, union people, factory people, farm people, if they lost their job, you know, they might not have, you know, they might lose their house if they got sick. If there was some type of health insurance. I'm not talking about the current type of health insulation that's out there, that people are so insulated from the process that there's no incentive to kind of reduce costs. If there was some type of health insurance out there that you're guaranteed not to lose your mortgage if you get sick, then maybe people might be more amenable to ideas such as free trade and economic regulation,
regulations. Wishful thinking. I think that's the nose under the camel's tent. One of the things that people do not fully understand, I think, is just how expansive a system, how intrusive you have to be in markets in order to give that guaranteed right. And this is the answer that I would give to it. in many cases, portability is something that could be done by markets, so that you can have an insurance company that writes a policy, and it says if worker A, who's covered by us, has a pre-existing condition, goes to firm B, covered by somebody else, they'll inherit the liability and we'll pay them a lump sum, so as to pick it up. Those kinds of assumptions could be done, and you could create portability by contract. In fact, I've been told but have not verified that there have been a number of restrictions on the enforceability of long-term insurance contracts that makes that serious, makes that difficult. The second thing is there are two ways to deal with insecurity, and you've picked the wrong one. You want to sort of guarantee the bottom when a guy doesn't have a job. But every one of these rules that we've been talking about, whether it's the discrimination rules, in many cases the safety rules, certainly the union rules and the minimum wage rules and so forth, they make it harder to get a second job. In particular, if you're over 40 today, you're protected against discrimination on grounds of age. Well, that helps you if you already have a job. But there's so many ways to turn people down who don't have jobs that it makes it difficult for people who are over 40 to get the jobs. So my solution is what you want to do is to reduce the anxiety that people rightly feel in the current market by expanding the opportunity sets, by removing the barriers to entry, which have been created by the stuff that took place in the 1930s, the labor acts and the minimum wage laws and the fair labor standards stuff, and then all the stuff that took place in the 1960s and 70s having to do with the anti-discrimination laws and various kinds of health mandates and minimums of one kind or another. And so I think that you certainly are correct to say that there's a problem, but you're advocating a second best solution. That is, we can't change the restrictions on labor mobility, so let's give people guaranteed minimums. And I'm saying unless you take care of the first thing, the second one's not going to help you. What you will do is you will create a health right. That health right will, in fact, increase the taxes on firms and on individuals. Once you do that, the rate of capital formation will go down, and the wage levels will start to go down, so that you will pay for this not only in taxes, but in terms of reduced opportunities. And the difference between me as a lawyer and most of these guys in the administration is I'm always looking for system-wide understanding based upon general equilibrium theory, which I've, you know, at some considerable personal cost, have tried to figure out to understand it. And these guys are all looking for partial solutions, and they never think in terms of a general equilibrium model. I mean, and you know, they're not dumb people, but they're not people who spend their full time in academics. I mean, Hillary Clinton's been a politician for 30 years. God knows Barack taught at the University of Chicago, but he just taught con law, and that's not teaching the stuff having to do with labor mobility and all the other things that I've been talking about. It really takes a grasp of the economic side of this thing, and it's not going to be enough to understand the very important and vital history associated with the advance of the civil rights movement in the period before 1964, where, remember, it was a very libertarian movement at that time, the civil rights movement. They were trying to get rid of government restrictions by way of segregation.
Professor Epstein, you've mostly been speaking about labor regulations and
agriculture
and anti-discrimination laws. Yeah. These are some things we've touched on. What would be your take on environmental regulations?
Well, environmental regulations are a very different beast. And in fact, the classical liberal position on this starts the following way. We have two individuals, and one of them commits what we used to call at common law a nuisance. And that means that he pollutes or emits smells and noises that give it a material interference with the enjoyment of a neighbor on his own land. And the question of whether or not these nuisances were things that you could protect against, it was widely understood that you could prevent them as early as 1200 in the Anglo-American legal system, which is basically from day one, and they were certainly understood in the Roman law system to be kinds of wrongs. So to the extent that environmental law is essentially pollution, noise, filth, and so forth writ large, there's absolutely no way that anybody who's in the liberal tradition that I'm in would say, gee, we'll let the market take care of these things. The market didn't take care of these things back in 1200. They're not going to take care of them today. You have to have some system of direct regulation. Well, what's the system of regulation going to be? Early on, it was the private right of action. That is, I can sue my neighbor for making filth. But there's a very instructive, a great decision, an extremely wise decision by the English courts in 1536, which talks about when a public nuisance hurts a large number of people in small ways, you don't ignore it. You have a public agency apply an administrative remedy to stop the harm. But the definition of a small nuisance is not different from the definition of a big nuisance, except with respect to size. And so, in fact, if you have a situation where somebody blocks a road and Mr. A happens to run into this thing and get himself seriously injured, he gets a private right of action because he's really been belted. But if now 100 other people are blocked so for the next hour they can't go anywhere, we don't want to pretend that those harms don't happen, right? So what you have to do is to have the state find the fellow who creates the blockade to get an incentive to remove him from the road or to reduce the likelihood. And once you do that, then these people will be more likely to be able to flow back and forth across the road. And pollution is the same kind of game. When you have pollution from one person to one person, private rights of action are fine. If you've got 3,000 or 3 million tailpipes in Los Angeles emitting smog that are breathed by 5 million people, you're not going to have that many lawsuits. So you must have a system of direct regulation. What's the limit? The limit is that the substantive theories under which the federal government or the state governments can proceed to regulate pollution must be identical to the theories that ordinary individuals could use in one-on-one regulation. Otherwise, what will happen is there'll be this massive strategic game in which you can do through regulation things that you could never accomplish through private action, even if their cost was zero. So that, for example, suppose you are my neighbor, right? And I don't like the fact that you built on your property because it blocks my view of the ocean. At common law, you could never sue.
I have a large, ugly, billboard I'm putting up, on my property.
Super, now, billboards are kind of funny in certain cases, but just stick with the house case, which is even easier. You want to stop somebody from building a house, the rule has always been you have to buy what they call a covenant in which he promises not to build it for the benefit of you and anyone who buys the land from you. And, well, now, in effect, if you go to a zoning board, you don't have to buy anymore because you say, oh, it's an environmental issue, preserving boards, and we'll just shut this guy down. So we build first. He can't build at all. And my view about it is if you want to go from private to public remedies, you cannot change the dynamics. If you have to pay when it's done privately, you have to pay when it's done publicly. And, of course, the environmental movement goes berserk over that. Because now, in effect, you have to start to pay, and it means that incumbent landowners cannot force the costs of their own particular developments on the absentee landowner who's yet to build. And, in fact, my rule has much better environmental properties than the other rules, because under the rules as they now exist, that you could block people through permits and so forth without having to pay them a dime, it, oddly enough, gives people an incentive to build sooner than they really ought, precisely because they now hope that they'll get something for nothing. Whereas in the rule that I'm talking about, which says that you have to pay for the covenant, there's no advantage in building early because you can't acquire the right over the neighbor. So if you really are interested in systematic, again, always systematic, understandings, a rule that basically protects the right to build without having to build is a rule which will be environmentally sounder than the current legal regime. And I actually wrote that in a brief in some of these cases, and writing it before the Supreme Court, it's like hitting your head against the wall. They simply come out of the progressive tradition, and they have so much deference to government, they don't believe in property rights, that they always assume that you're in favor of property rights, you're really in favor of some terrible degradation of the environment, and they mess everything up.
Professor Epstein, it's definitely seems like a complicated scenario with the environmental regulations.
Yeah, but it's not a scenario which says, hey, environmental protection is useless. It's an extremely important subject, and there's no doubt that state and federal governments have the power to regulate environmental harms. You just really have to work at it in a way in which the modernists have not.
Yeah, and there was some stuff I wish we could have gotten to. We actually got another caller calling in a couple minutes. I wish we could have gotten to the state police power and some other things.
Well, talk about it, some other time.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. Professor Epstein, it's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming out. We'd love to have you on another time, maybe talk about, Lochner and the benefits of Supreme Court striking down state police power economic regulations and things like that.
It was a lot of fun talking to you, particularly since you have no commercials.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're on the public airwaves, so.
Okay, well, that's the more complicated situation. We could talk about how you allocate spectrum to us. But anyhow, take care, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Professor Epstein.
Okay, bye-bye, guys.